From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Generational Crossroads of History. Whether you are older, you're middle-aged, or you're just coming of age, this is the only program you'll find anywhere in the country where every generation has a voice. I'm Phil Marriage, and this is the October 27th edition, and our topic today is domestic violence. This is really going to be an important program for me to say what I normally say at the beginning of the program. If you can't stay with us for the entire program, or you'd like to hear the longer version, be sure and go to our website at www.yttshow.org. You can listen to the longer podcast there. There'll be a lot more information. And if you'd like to share this program with someone you know, a relative, or someone in your life, this is the time that the podcast will be very important. So take advantage of that. And there, while you're also at the website, you can check our focus questions for our upcoming programs. You can find out a lot more information about the program in general. Domestic violence is the topic today. I have three terrific guests with me. Speaking from the older generation, her name is Charlotte Carroll. She founded the Restoration of Hope, which is a domestic violence shelter in Stuttgart back in 1997 here in Arkansas. She was married 23 years to a violent man who used a gun barrel in her mouth to control her, and he threatened to kill her, and she finally was able to break away from him. And Charlotte Carroll, welcome to our program today.
Thank you, Phil. It's nice to be here.
And then speaking from the younger generation is Amanda White. She is a volunteer outreach coordinator for the SalineCountySafeHaven.org. That's the only shelter in Saline County, and she also is a victims advocate and survivor of violence herself. Amanda White, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you, and I'm so glad to be here.
And then our special guest joining us from Washington, D.C. is Leslie Morgan Steiner. Leslie was a guest on our program back in 2006 in July. We did a program then on balancing work and family after her book then, which was Mommy Wars, and you probably heard her on NPR and various other locations in time. She's a New York Times bestselling author, a columnist with the Washington Post, spespeaker on work and family balance, domestic violence survivor, and her latest book is the one we're talking about today, is Crazy Love. Leslie Morgan Steiner, so glad to have you back here with us on our program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Leslie, let me start with you in that middle generation, but also looking back. I was just thinking about the fact that you've been on tour talking about your book in a number of different places around the country, I'm sure. And I'm really curious as to what you have found in those interviews to be the, if you could give it a grade rating or some sort of perspective on where we are in the nation with domestic violence.
Well, I think we're actually in quite a good place. There's definitely a lot more work that needs to be done, but we've come a long time in my lifetime. I'm 44, and when I was born, there were no domestic violence shelters. There were no 24-hour hotlines that women could call. You know, your best bet was that if you were being abused, if you had a sympathetic family member or friend, you would have to call them. But in some cases, you couldn't even count on the police to help. So now we have shelters in every community and lots of hotlines that you can call for help and support. And in that way, we've really come a long way in terms of recognizing that domestic violence is a crime. No one should suffer through it. Now, we have a long way to go because you still hear these terrible stories about women who had restraining orders that police didn't respect or that abusers didn't respect, or women who had the strength to leave their abusers but then got dragged down in the family court system. So we still need more work and more advocacy. But in general, I think our country is in a very supportive and open-minded place.
Well, I'll come back to you, Leslie, with a little bit about your particular story, but I kind of want to jump back to Charlotte Carroll and in that older generation. You're 64, I think, is what you told me. And thinking back on the domestic violence when it first came into your life, what was the nature of the world that you lived in then when domestic violence started for you?
When the domestic violence was going on in my life, that was something that wasn't discussed. That was something that was strictly kept behind closed doors. You were ashamed to have any bruises. You hid everything that you could. You became a very good liar about the bruises that you got. You know, you were very accident prone. You just didn't discuss it. That was something that no one heard about outside the doors of your home.
Did this violence for you, did it start right at the beginning of your relationship?
It did, but I didn't realize it. When we were dating, he was very controlling then, but as I have found out and it's come out into the light of the behavior of domestic violence abusers, he was very controlling, but I thought it was because he loved me. You know, he wanted to be with me all the time. He wanted to know where I was at all the time. He just wanted to control everything that I did or where I went, just every part of my life.
Well, as Leslie was talking about, the nature of domestic violence has been really kind of the same. When you were young, did you have any past experience with domestic violence from either grandparents or other places?
None whatsoever. I was completely ignorant to domestic violence. And when my husband had his first fit, is what I call it, he got mad because I told him we didn't have enough money for him to go on a hunting spree. And he would make me do control the money, but he wanted to know where every penny of it went. But he thought that he should have enough left over to do what he wanted to do. So when I sat down and explained to him where the money went, then he would get mad and he would put his fist through the wall, or he would get mad and start cursing and throwing things and stating, you know, I work hard and I don't have enough of this and that. And I got between the wall and the refrigerator and was just shaking because I didn't know what to think. And then as it progressed, we had horses and he got thrown a few times, and also we were building a barn and a large timber fell on his head. So I thought that he had a brain tumor or something, that there was something wrong with him, the reason he was acting that way. You know, you just don't think anybody could act that way and be normal. And then he began to, first it was cursing and putting me down and screaming and yelling and punching doors, and then he began to punch me. I was scared. I didn't know what to say to anybody. I didn't know how to act. He would go to the store for cigarettes, and he'd be gone over the weekend. He would come home, and I would ask him where he had been, and he would have a fit. You know, it's none of your business. You don't jump on me the minute I come in the door. And all I did was ask him where he'd been, and immediately he just blew up. So then if he went for the weekend and came home and I didn't say anything, then I had been with someone. I was hiding something. I didn't care about him. What did I do? He turned it completely around.
Well, did you have any friends your age at that time that you talked with about this at all?
I had friends, but I did not talk about it.
Well, let me move up to Leslie Morgensteiner then. Leslie, I know in your bio that you sent me, you really started seeing violence in your first relationship when you were only 22.
Yes. My abusive husband, I met him when I was 22. And I had just graduated from college, and he had too. And it started out as a lot of these relationships do, that it struck me as a fairy tale. You know, he was so handsome and funny and devoted to me, and I didn't see that he was possessive and controlling. I really saw, I was flattered by it. And we married, and he started abusing me just a few days before our wedding. I've learned since is a common pattern for abusers, that they often will hit you, or the first attack occurs right at the time of a major commitment. Part of it is because of the stress that they feel, and part of it also is that they know that you can't leave. I had moved from New York City to a small town in New England. I didn't know what to do. I was scared, but I didn't believe that it had happened in a way. I had very strong denial, and I knew he was a good person in a lot of ways and that he loved me, and I just was able to write it off to the stress of the wedding. And then he attacked me again twice on the honeymoon, and we kind of, you know, settled in as much as you can settle in to a pattern of violence every week or few weeks. It gradually really wore me down and changed me from the outgoing and confident person that I had been when I had met him to somebody who was really afraid almost all the time without fully realizing it.
And you never saw any of this other than just right prior to your wedding?
I couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. I would tell you that other people, my friends and family members, told me later after I had left him, they had been worried at the since the beginning. They had seen red flags that I had not been able to see because I was so blinded by my love and affection for him. He was a very angry person. He had been physically abused himself as a young child by his stepfather, which is a big warning sign. And he was obviously controlling to other people, but I just didn't see it that way. It took me a long time, even after the abuse had started, to see myself as a battered woman. For a long time, I just thought I was in love with a really troubled man who I thought I could help. And I had no idea how wrong I was.
Did you have a lot of the verbal abuse too?
I didn't. Verbal and emotional abuse is really common. It's even much more common than physical violence. But what made my relationship so incredibly confusing to me is that when we weren't having a fight, my husband really liked me a lot, and he almost worshipped me. You know,
wow.
He was always telling me that He thought I was so smart and beautiful and that I could do anything, and he really thought the world of me, which obviously felt really great, and it felt like the way a relationship was supposed to be. But then when he lost his temper, and again, it was over tiny things. It was over if we didn't have enough money to buy coffee, or if I hadn't made him breakfast properly, or if he was just in an angry mood, he would lash out at me. And sometimes he would hit me. He had guns, too, and so sometimes he would hold a gun to my head.
Wow.
He would shove me. He would do weird things, too, like throw food at me or pour coffee grinds on my head. Or one day he pulled the key out of our car ignition when we were driving down the highway. It was almost as if he was a tiny child, like a four-year-old kid trapped in a grown-up man's body. He was so overcome by his temper. And it made me feel really sorry for him for a long time before I realized that instead of feeling sorry for him, I had to be really scared for myself.
I can agree with that, Leslie. What you're saying is so much a pattern of my life, and I think it's a pattern of every abused woman, because I've had a lot of my clients say, was your husband my husband's brother, you know? They sound so much alike.
I know, I hear that too. I've gotten, Crazy Love came out, I've gotten a lot of people who've said, you know, I think you were married to my ex-husband.
Right.
Because, and you know, what is unfortunate is that a lot of times domestic violence victims are the ones who get stereotyped. There's this cultural stereotype that we're sort of weak and insecure and we don't think very much of ourselves. But what I see is that the only stereotypes are the ones that apply to the abusers, that there's a lot of common patterns on the abuser side, not so much the victim side. Because every victim I meet is different. We're just sort of regular people who kind of fell in love with the wrong person at the wrong time. Perpetrators have a lot in common.
Well, I find that the victims have a lot in common because they're very caring and nurturing people. And
yeah, I find that too. You don't hear about that from the stereotypes, you know, but I think it's true. Sometimes I think it's the best part of me that loved him, and that actually is what made me vulnerable.
Let's bring Amanda White into the conversation from that younger perspective. Amanda, listening to what Charlotte Carroll has talked about from that older perspective, and then Leslie Morgensteiner talking about pretty much the same, how is it for younger people? Is it the same for you?
It was completely the same. My abuser was actually my seventh grade crush. He was captain of the football team, and we ended up getting together whenever I was close to 21, and it was the same thing. He was my Prince Charming that fell head over heels in love with him. We were going to conquer the world together and do everything we had ever dreamed of, and the abuse started very slowly, basically with a push and a shove here and there, but it was always inside of a heated argument. I rationalized it away, that it wouldn't have happened if I wouldn't have been so angry too, or those types of things. And when the actual worst of the violence started was actually after I became pregnant. And as she stated, that's whenever he knew that I wasn't going anywhere. We had a child together, and that's what's very common in a lot of relationships, as far as that's the point where they feel like they have the ultimate power and control over their person, over their victim, because they have the commitment. They have, you have these long ties together. You know, especially after someone buys a house together, or you know, gets pregnant with a child together, you know you're going to be attached to that person for life, regardless of what happens. I believe that abusers take that as almost a license to do what they want.
Let me ask you, is the word trapped something all three of you would say you felt in at that stage, Amanda?
Not at that stage. I did a little later, whenever I really realized what was going on and that it wasn't going to stop. As both of the other ladies have said, I had a huge caring heart, and I truly believed that I could fix my abuser. I believed that as long as I got him the help he needed, or we did this the right way, then it would go back to the person that I fell in love with.
How about you, Leslie, trapped?
When I look back now, I am very aware of the feeling of being trapped. But at the time, it was a very subtle psychological trap. In some ways, I was trapped by love. Because one thing about me that I think is kind of useful is that I wasn't trapped by financial pressures, and I never had children with my abuser, kind of thank God. And
yeah.
I literally could have walked out any day. But I still couldn't. I could never leave. I mean, I could leave for 10 minutes and drive around the neighborhood, but I just couldn't leave him. I couldn't abandon him because I still was so hopeful that I could help him and that we would recapture that early love that we had together. And he had been left by so many women, and I felt really sorry for him. So in some ways, I was trapped by what I thought was love,
yeah,
by a kind of pity for him. And it really wasn't until the very end of the relationship where he beat me very, very badly, and there was one night where I was sure he was going to kill me. The neighbors and the police intervened. But during that time when I was sure he was going to kill me, I realized that it was a choice between him or me. It was that simple. And I sort of said to myself, you know, I do love him, but I don't love him more than I love myself. And I'm going to pick myself over him. And for me, that was the end of it. It wasn't easy getting out of the marriage. He became very charming again and said all the right things. But I stuck to it, and I ended up, you know, permanently ending the relationship and starting my life over when I was 27.
27. Charlotte Carroll, trapped for people your age, did you feel trapped too?
Well, Phil, the longer you're in a relationship like that, the harder it is to get out. You have so many ties. And I was married for 23 years. Needless to say, when he put that gun in my mouth, it was like a light came on, and I thought, you know, he's going to kill me if I stay, or he's going to kill me if I leave. So I need to try to leave. At that time, my son was going into his first year of college, and my daughter was going to the 10th grade. And I thought, well, I can make it away with one better than having two. But, you know, my son would be okay because he would be in college, and then my daughter would be all right because she'd be with me. But it didn't work out the way I planned. I felt sorry for him, and I had to quit feeling sorry for him. That's what drew me back. He didn't have anybody but me and his family. And just like Leslie, I was going to fix him. And it took me 23 years to realize that I couldn't fix him. And that hurt. I mean, that was 23 years of my life that, other than my two wonderful children that I got from this marriage, it would have been a failure. And it hurt me because there was no help for him. I couldn't fix it, and I felt like a failure as a wife and a mother because I had lived for so long, put my children through all of this torture of hearing their mother crying and screaming, please don't hit me anymore, and all the things that go through a domestic violence relationship. It really left a lot of scars.
I hate to throw a monkey wrench into the discussion here, but I'm sure that there are many, many, many people listening to the program today who are either victims of domestic violence themselves or somebody in their family is, male or female. And this is, I was thinking before the program, I don't know why in 9 years that I haven't done the topic of domestic violence. And maybe the answer is that I'm a victim of it too. I'm a guy who went through almost everything I'm hearing you ladies say. But it was in my first marriage, and it showed up 2 weeks after the marriage. No indication of anything prior to it in a year of dating before that. No indication at all. And it was 2 children later, 10 years worth of marriage, all the same things that you guys are saying, but from the male perspective. All the violence was there in the same way. So I guess my question, coming back to you, Leslie, and talking to the people you've talked to over the country, what's the male end of this thing?
You know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because we hear almost exclusively about women who are victims. And I, in the radio programs that I've done and the emails I've gotten, and also especially for this past month, October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I've traveled all over the country and talked to a lot of people. You don't hear about it as much, but men are victims too. And also,
yes,
obviously, children are victims. Whether they are abused or they just see their parent being abused, they are victims too. And I think that anybody can be an abuser, and anybody can be a victim. And I think it's harder for men to come out and talk about it because there's sort of this disbelief that a woman could abuse a man. But I tell you, I hear about it a lot, and I hear terrible stories of men being really tortured and humiliated by their wives and physically attacked in ways that are exactly the way I was attacked. And one of the most powerful emails that I got was from a gay man who said, you know, I didn't expect to identify with your story at all, but here I am, a man with a different sexual orientation, and I felt like you told my story. So I think that we victims have so much in common. It's one of the silver linings of the problem, is that victims can really support each other and really provide each other a lot of sympathy and guidance to get out and also to rebuild your lives.
Charlotte said it took her 23 years. It took me 10. How long did it take you, Leslie?
It took me 4 years.
Four. How about you, Amanda?
11.
11 years. What is wrong with us that we would stay that long?
I think that there is not something wrong with us. You might find other people with a different view, but as Charlotte was talking, I think that people who are victims, they tend to be very forgiving people. very big-hearted, and I think we have to acknowledge that the abusers themselves are very, very good at what they do, whether they're consciously doing it or unconsciously replicating what happened to them in their childhood. They can be incredibly charming. And, you know, one of the most interesting things I think that Charlotte said was how her husband kept getting her back because of the way he was good at making her feel sorry for him. And that's something that my ex-husband did very well, too. From the very beginning, I felt a lot of pity for him, and pity can be really seductive. And I've been married to my second husband for 15 years. We have 3 children. It's a very happy ending. And I never once in my life have felt sorry for him. I think pity is just not part of a normal adult relationship. I think that the abusers are very talented at keeping us in the relationship and saying exactly the right thing to make us stay and to forgive them again and again and again.
I had one thing to add. Also, I really believe, too, that abusers look for a certain type of individual. And they look for people with self-esteem problems. They look for weaknesses in people that they actually can turn and use against themselves. And a lot of it is the very forgiving and the very caring and the very nurturing individuals, because once they have you, as she said, with the pity, or as whenever you are, you know, lost in that wonderful love, then you're going to turn your blind eye to the things that are bad that weren't there in the very beginning.
Well, let me ask all three of the same question, because I think you're describing the same thing that I heard when I was doing some therapy counseling during my situation there, the giver and the taker, that there's a giver in a relationship and a taker. Charlotte Carroll, was that the case in your situation?
Exactly. I gave all of the nurturing tenderness, and my husband could be tender and very, very charismatic, just like Leslie was talking about. They're not monsters. They don't show you that side of themselves, but that is the side that you are marrying. Think you're marrying the one that they put on to be, and you keep thinking that person's going to come back. But what has really happened is that person is the one that you married. You know, a lot of times that's why it's such a short relationship, short engagement, because if it's a long-term relationship, you're going to see something. But you will see warning signs even though you ignore them.
Well, Leslie, is that the same with you, giver and taker, and finally reaching a final straw of being the taker or the giver?
I would describe it a little bit differently, because I think that, you know, ironically, my ex-husband gave a lot to me, too, and taught me a lot of good things separate from the abuse. But in the relationship, the thing that I look back now and think was very wrong was that everything was focused on him. He was the one with the troubled childhood. He was the one who needed help. He was the one we were going to fix. And all of the battles that we were fighting together as a couple, they were mostly his battles. And I was sort of like his trusty number two soldier. And there was a real final straw. Something that we haven't talked about very much, but that was really powerful for me, was that I had tremendous denial about what was happening. And I thought that every incident was just a one-time deal, and surely enough, he never did the exact same thing twice. So I was able to say, well, that just happened once because of XYZ, and it's never going to happen again. But then in the final beating, it was just, there was something about it that was so very serious. And also, he had gone for 6 months without beating me before that, so I'd had a time of my denial breaking down.
Wow.
And I also found it very significant that our neighbors and the police intervened, and that they broke through my denial too, and they said, the police in particular, were very kind to me, and they said, you know what, he could kill you next time. And we see this all the time. It's very serious. And that helped me, too. It gave me a very cold dose of reality, and for me, that was the final straw.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, same thing, giver, taker, and the final straw?
Yes, there was a definite give-and-take relationship in our relationship, and I really believe that I was the giver. As she said, my husband also taught me a lot of things that were very good outside of our abuse, and things that, in my mind, I was very naive whenever I met and married my ex-husband. I believe people didn't tell you things if they weren't real. I didn't ever believe someone would tell you that they loved you just to get what they wanted. And he taught me a lot about the world that I wasn't able to learn on my own. But the final straw actually was when it came down to a choice of either me, it was either me or him, but it was also more about my children. I actually have 4 boys, and whenever I learned what they were seeing and the way that they felt they were worth nothing, it really hit home, and I realized that I didn't want to raise four abusers. I did not want for the next generation that coming up in them to end up thinking that this was okay.
Well, folks, if you're listening to the program, just tuned in. We're talking about domestic violence today here on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. This, I guarantee, is one program you might want to catch the podcast on at www.yttshow.org. You can just click on Listen. The podcast will be there. A lot more information than we can get in our half-hour program here. My guest, speaking from the older generation, joining us from Stuttgart is Charlotte Carroll. She runs Restoration of Hope Domestic Violence Shelter down there. Amanda White, who is with the Saline County SafeHaven.org, the same thing. She's one of the volunteer outreach coordinators there. And our special guest is Leslie Morgensteiner, joining us from Washington, D.C. She's the author of Crazy Love. As I mentioned, this is a program, I think I understand now why I haven't done it in 9 years. It's close to my heart, too, and it really is a tough thing to talk about, domestic violence. And if you're listening to the program today and finding something about this program that rings true to either yourself or someone in your family, talk about it with them. I think that's probably one of the big things is we need to have some part of our takeaway of this program is what can people do? Let me start that first with you, Charlotte, talking about older people who have gone through a lifetime of domestic violence, and I guess with your shelter down there, what would you advise people to do who are older?
Well, I talked with a lady that was 70 years old that was still in a domestic violence relationship, and she felt like that she had to stay because she went out on her husband while he was in the service, and she deserved everything that she got. No matter what I told her, how I talked to her, nothing was going to change her mind because she felt like she was such a bad person, she deserved it. That's how good they are at making you feel undeserving of having a good life, I guess.
It almost sounds like you're saying that the male in that case saw the weakness in the female and used that as a trap to trap her.
Exactly, and she said that she was 70 years old, and why leave now? You know, she had been through it all, and that it wasn't as often anymore. You know, sometimes it was severe, sometimes it wasn't. If she put up with it that long, she's not going to live much longer, so.
Do you hear the case of a lot of older people with domestic violence?
No, not really. There's some domestic violence with the children, you know, with their mothers, but not with partners.
Leslie Morgensteiner, in that middle generation time frame there, what would you tell people who are where you were at that age and what they should do? What's available to them?
I would say that the most important thing that I've learned is that abuse of any kind thrives only in secret. And the most important thing you can do is to talk to somebody about it. And I think, you know, being on this show and all four of us talking about it and everybody who's listening, we're actually all taking a step to end domestic violence just by being open about it. And there are hotlines that you can call. There are shelters that you can call. There are a lot of support programs. If you can reach out and talk to somebody about it, it really is very effective in terms of breaking down your denial, establishing a safe person for you to go to. It usually takes people a really long time to leave, very many attempts to leave, and there's nothing to be ashamed of about that, but you need it really helps to have friends and even strangers. Sometimes strangers can help a lot more than your friends and family, believe it or not.
Hmm.
So my advice to anybody of any age is to tell somebody.
Amanda White, you're in that younger generation. You live at a time when we're talking about domestic violence. Do young people, do they fall victims of this just like we're hearing from the middle and the older generation? What do young people do?
The same thing. I think domestic violence is one of those topics that age does not matter. It's the same thing with age, sex, race, their socioeconomic status. Anyone can fall victim to it. The biggest thing that I could do is agree with them, and the main thing is to call out, to ask for help, to know, to not be ashamed, to don't think that you deserve this because it's happening, and to reach out to anyone, even if it is just the local police because they get called to your house, or whether you can't. I mean, there's a National Domestic Violence Hotline. I think we have 32 shelters in the state of Arkansas. And most communities do have a place for women to look now. And also, I actually head our Marriage Youth Council, and they have adopted our teen dating violence as their project for the last several years. Through them, we are actually able to go into high schools and to middle schools and are teaching the younger generation, even younger than I am, to recognize the signs whenever it's just dating violence. And I had a room of over 30 high school students, and we explained the signs of dating violence and asked them to raise their hand if they knew anyone who was in that sort of relationship. And every single hand, yes. And so it starts out just like every abusive relationship starts out. It's the subtle jealousy. It's the not wanting that person to wear that type of clothing, to only want them to hang around certain friends, and the patterns then progress. But as Leslie said, if you get to speak out and talk to somebody about it, it does thrive in secrecy, and especially abusers like to isolate their victims to where they're the only one that they're coming into contact with. That way they cannot hear any difference of opinion than the one that they're feeding them. And so if you're able to talk about it, a light goes off. Wait, this is normal.
Well, let me stay with you, Amanda. And since we're talking about the signs of domestic abuse, start ticking off some of the signs that are relevant to domestic violence, some of the things that maybe people don't really recognize but are really there.
As Leslie called it, we call them red flags, which are they're just warning signs. Normally, abusers have really low self-esteem. They do like to have several problems for people to feel guilty of them. But also, you have the very, very quick involvement. You have unrealistic expectations as far as what can be accomplished personally or in your relationship. A lot of, especially younger, I'd say 20 and younger, if they're very, very abusive to animals, that's a huge sign to go off.
One of the ones that I would add is that quite often before somebody abuses you, they introduce the threat of violence. They'll punch a wall in your presence or slam their hand really hard on the table or say something like, you know, if I weren't such a gentleman, I'd hit you right now.
Oh.
When you see the threat of violence, that is a precursor to the violence itself, and that's a huge red flag. And then often the violence itself starts out very subtle. You know, I always say to people, an abuser doesn't hit you on the first date. They wait until you trust them, and then they might, you know, like my the first time that I was attacked, he didn't actually hit me, he choked me. And this was really significant because I was able to say to myself, well, he didn't hit me. You know, he didn't hold a gun to my head, even though he did those things later. You know, he just choked me and he was just mad. And so I think that anything that is a threat of violence, I think that normal people don't use violence that way in an intimate relationship. So if you see any of that, you really should talk about it to other people right then and see what somebody else thinks if they think that's normal.
Charlotte, Carol, any signs that you would recognize for people?
I agree with both Amanda and Leslie about all of the signs. I know that when I was first married, my husband rolled me up in the mattress and sat on it because I didn't get up out of bed when he said, get up, the first time. And he almost suffocated me, you know, and to this day I have claustrophobia. They don't hit you on the first date. They don't show their real side until they have you where they want you and they know it.
Well, one of the things I want to bring into the discussion here, and I don't want to leave this out, and that is the fact that there are long-term effects for those of us who have been victimized by domestic violence. And a lot of times, though, I know in my own case, as I mentioned already a couple times in the program, one reason I probably haven't brought this program up before is because it is deep and it has long-lasting things. And when you begin to talk about it, it really hurts to talk about this kind of stuff. So let's start in that older generation with you, Charlotte, Carol. What are the lingering things? I know you were in it for 23 years. You've been out of it for a little while. What has stayed with you? Really kind of hard for you to deal with even now?
Well, it was really hard for me to talk about it after it was over with. I was going to forget it and bury it and never bring it up again. But I worked with people that were abused. I reached out to them. And then in church, I would notice. I could tell if a woman was being abused or not. And I would befriend her and get her to talking. And then I would help her. So that led me to open Restoration of Hope. And in doing so, it has healed me.
Leslie, for you, what have been the lingering things that are hard to get over?
You know, it's funny because in some ways the lingering effects of being a domestic violence survivor in many ways are blessings, the way that I see them. The number one effect for me is that I am really afraid of people who lose their temper, and I think that's healthy. I don't want to be in a relationship, even a friendship or a professional relationship, with somebody whose rage overcomes them, because I find it really frightening. And before I was in my marriage, I wasn't afraid of it. I thought I could take anything and I could help anybody. And now I just have a lot of respect for the power of somebody who's out of control with anger, and I don't want to be around them. I want to teach my kids to not be around people who are angry like that. So I think that's a long-term effect. I also feel like, for me, one of the best things that's happened to me is to take something bad, like being in this terrible relationship, and to turn it into a force for good. And for me, that's talking about it and writing my book, Crazy Love, mm-hmm, and I made mm-hmm. a video about it. And all of that, you could say that that's a lingering effect. Obviously, I had a lot of healing that I had to help myself with, but I think that's good. And I think the fact that Charlotte Carroll has started a group to help women is also a really good lingering effect. And I think sometimes we sort of feel so sorry for a domestic violence victim that you don't realize how strong many of us are and what good things we go on to do as a result of having been victims ourselves. For so many people, there is a really happy ending and a second chance to help ourselves and to help others.
Incidentally, you, with your book, Crazy Love, are you still on tour, and how can people get a hold of it?
They can come to my website, which is lesliemorgensteiner.com. I also do a lot of work with the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and if they come to that website, I'm often writing for that. And that's, in general, just a great resource. It's www.ndvh.org, and they have a wonderful hotline, which is 1-800-799-SAFE. That victims can call, and also family members and friends or coworkers. They offer a whole lot of support. So I'm easy to find. And I really believe in the power of telling our stories. So on my website, I have something called the Crazy Love Project, where I anonymously will post anybody's story if you want to speak out and, you know, tell people what you went through. It's a great way to help yourself and also to help other women.
And incidentally, I'll put that information on our website, too, under our archive for this program. If, those of you listening, if you want to find out that information for the Restoration of Hope and the Saline County Safe Haven, I'll have Leslie Morgan Steiner's information. That'll be on our website also at yttshow.org. Amanda White, I know you're young yet. What are the lingering effects for you?
Actually, I've only been out of my relationship since 2004, and so it's still fairly new. I think the biggest lingering effect for me is trust issues. I'm very, very cautious as far as dating, as far as introducing anyone to my children. And the thought of actually trying to live with someone again almost still gives me panic attacks because I gave up so much control over my life and my children's lives to my ex-husband that I don't ever want to do that again. But as Leslie said, I have become very, very passionate, and I speak publicly all the time. I tell my story. I actually have pictures, photographs of the worst abuse that I actually suffered. And so I'm blessed enough to be able to share those pictures with the public, with other people, so they can see what really happened. My parents kid me because they think that I've become a poster child for Arkansas as far as domestic violence goes, because so many people are afraid to talk about it. And part of it, I think, is the embarrassment and the shame that you do feel about allowing that stuff to happen to you. But I have actually testified in front of the Senate and the legislature. I've actually helped raise more money for domestic violence programs throughout the state. I've been able to do so many good things and help so many people that I've been able to help on a one-on-one basis or just by telling my story. I knew when it got the worst it had ever gotten, I was at the hospital and the doctor told me that there was no medical reason that I was still alive, let alone standing up and talking. And at that point, I knew that it was about something bigger than me. And I truly believe that I've been blessed to be here to be able to do those things.
Well, Leslie, let me come back to you and ask, and I'm not sure if you have this information, but how bad is it nationally? Are we talking about a situation where, I know we're talking generationally here today, and actually to me it sounds like not much is different between the older, middle, and younger generation with domestic violence. So how bad is the problem?
Well, it's very common, and the statistics are really grim. 3 women are killed every day in the United States through intimate partner violence. And when you add up domestic violence incidents and stalking, which is another form of abuse, nearly 5 million women are affected every year by it. So it's really, really common. And whenever I speak, I say to people, you know, I promise you know somebody who is being abused right now, and your children know children who are being abused. It's very common in our culture and in every culture around the world, unfortunately. And that's, you know, why I think it's so great that we're all talking about it, so that when the next time somebody is hurt, they will know that it happened before and that people survived it and they can get out too.
So if you're driving down the freeway today somewhere here in the state or wherever you might be listening to this program, and you look across the lanes and you see all that traffic, there's bound to be some abuse going on in one or two of those vehicles, wouldn't you say?
Yep, or the, you know, people in your office or people in your neighborhood or your children's school. It's really common. And one of the, you know, the terrible things about domestic violence is that, as Charlotte Carroll said at the beginning, it all happens behind closed doors, whether it's the doors of a house or quite often the doors of a car, which is where a lot of violence happens, hidden. And the abusers can be so charming and wonderful that it's really hard to believe that it is happening. But, and sort of like Charlotte had said, I think that victims develop a radar, a sort of a sixth sense for who is being abused, because I feel like I can feel that too. And I would just say to everybody, to look out for it and to be really sympathetic if anybody ever does come to you and confesses that they are being abused by their mother or their father or their husband or their wife or their boyfriend, and to take it very seriously.
Well, one group that we talked about a little bit on the sidelines, but I think is probably one of the reasons why all of us stayed where we were for as long as we did, was the children. So let me come back to you, Charlotte Carroll, and ask about the nature of the children in domestic violence situations. Why is that the most important reason to change?
I left my husband several times before I left for good. When they were smaller, they would cry. They missed their dog. Got to understand that women just have to pick up their children and leave, basically the clothes on their back. The children don't have time to get their blankie. They don't have time to get their favorite toy. And they're thrust into this unknown day, you know, what's going to happen from minute to minute or day to day. It's very difficult for children, and it's very difficult for women to overcome all the barriers. Even when they get into our shelter, they come up against the barrier. They have to have an automobile. They have to have a job. To the job, they have to have an automobile, but they have to have a job to buy an automobile, to have insurance. They basically start out with nothing, and then they run up against all of these barriers till they think, you know, so I got beat every now and then. I think I'd rather go home and at least have a roof over my head and my kids have halfway of a decent life rather than me getting told, no, you can't do this and no, you can't do that because you don't have this or you don't have that. You know, and a lot of them are just trapped. So they go back. And with me, my son was 16 years old when my husband threw me on the floor and was beating my head up against the floor. My son stood there with his fist clenched, biting his lip and tears running down his cheeks. And he wanted to hit his dad so badly. And I realized that there was going to come a time when my son did not stop, that it may come to the point to where he shot his dad or his dad killed him. And I didn't want that to happen. And I think that finally, along with a few other things, because leaving is a process, and I had left enough times to know what to expect. And at that time, like I said, my son was going away to college, so I had him taken care of. Now all I had to do was get away with my daughter and live to see that my daughter got to go to college and so forth, you know, because if I killed my husband, I would be put in jail and my kids would have no one. But if my husband killed my son, I would have killed him, and then my daughter would have been left out, you know, without a mom, dad, or a brother. All of that you have to take into consideration, because every abused woman is a possible homicide.
Well, Amanda, what about you? I know you said that you had children, too. What factor did that play in it for a young person?
It was really hard, especially considering I had four very small children. They were actually five and under whenever I finally did leave. But the possibility of trying for one person to grab up four children and leave and to get away with all of the children and no one being hurt, it's just absolutely physically impossible. Towards the end, if he thought that I was thinking about leaving or any signs like that, he would make sure I could never leave the house with all four children, or that, you know, I could only take one with me, or we would be left at home with no transportation, no phone, that type of thing. But the kids are really the most important part in all of this, because I truly believe with everything in me that we will not ever really get anywhere as far as the domestic violence movement goes, as far as any of that, until we teach our children that it's not okay to hit, whether it be man, woman, it doesn't matter. That's just not a way to solve their problems with violence. And until that message is instilled in every school all across the nation, we're going to continue to see the same problems happening. And it is such a generational curse as far as when small children grow up in a home where they are seeing their father abused their mother, or their mother abused their father, they actually grow up with a twisted sense of reality where they believe that's what love is.
Right.
And so they grow up to be adults, and that if it's not happening in their relationship, a lot of times they will subconsciously create it, because that's what they really truly believe love is. And if that person isn't hitting me or being mean to me, then they must not love me.
Well, Leslie Morgensteiner, I know you mentioned that you didn't have children at the time of your first marriage, thankfully, but I'm sure that you've heard the stories about the factors of children involved. Tell us what you think about that, and then if you can, kind of take a look at the future, if you would.
Well, I think what is so hard is that when you have children, it becomes harder to leave, but also much more important to leave, because they are going to suffer a lifetime of problems if they continue to associate love and violence together. And I believe that that is why my ex-husband abused me, is that because he had been so badly abused by his stepfather, he thought that violence and love went together. And I think that what has to happen in the future, it's been particularly striking as I've listened to Amanda and Charlotte Carroll talk, is that we, as a society, we need to recognize that people who abuse others are criminals. And a woman who is being abused, she shouldn't have to leave her house. And her children shouldn't have to go into a shelter. It should be the opposite, and that we as a society protect the people who have been abused. It's so hard to believe that somebody who has been abused and quite often has very clear proof that she has been abused, that she is not protected more thoroughly by the police and the courts in our country. And my hope for the future is that one day that women and children and anybody who is vulnerable gets the protection that they need from our society. I think that's when we will really end domestic violence.
Well, let me ask, did all three of you have the police involved in your situations over the years at various times?
Yes.
Let's make that all four of us, because I did it the same way, trying to get police intervention from the male end of the deal. Wasn't any better for me. And I hear so much of, in wrapping up the program today, it sounds like nothing has really changed. And Leslie, as you're talking, that maybe there's hope for the future, but this is a tough road, isn't it?
I think that it is, but I do think that a lot has changed. I think maybe it's not fast enough for the four of us because we'd like to see the problem end, you know, at this exact moment. But we have made a lot of progress. And, you know, in my situation, the police were really good to me, and that is a big change. You know, it used to be that the police wouldn't believe you or would just say it was a family problem and they would leave it alone. Where I ran into trouble was in the family court system, and that's where I hear now that a lot of people run into trouble. And I think that judges and attorneys and prosecutors have to understand domestic violence much more clearly. And I think right now we expect way too much of victims. You know, you expect a victim who's been through this terrible trauma and sometimes years or decades of trauma, and we expect her to prosecute her abuser and get up in court and be very proactive in her defense. And that's just expecting too much. I think that the police need to step in and the local criminal justice system needs to step in and take it very, very seriously, because it is potential homicide, you know, especially when there's proven abuse and guns involved. You know, in the blink of an eye, that could be somebody dying.
I did want to bring in one thing that she mentioned as far as the police and the court. In our county, I'm responsible for training all of the law enforcement now.
Really?
And I actually developed a curriculum that was targeted for law enforcement that's called Unlocking Domestic Violence. Why does she stay? And I actually teach the power and control wheel, the dynamics of domestic violence, but also I brought into it the betrayal bond circle, where actually the rescuer, the victim, and the abuser will switch places. And this actually explains to police officers why, when they come to a scene where a victim has called them, that the victim will attack them because they're trying to obtain the perpetrator. And it has actually worked wonders in our county, whereas getting our criminal justice system involved, getting all of these people on the same page as far as what is going on whenever they
a program like that is exactly what every county in the United States needs. And Amanda, you're just showing everybody how the power of one person, you know, that you could put together a program like that. And I imagine that your work has protected a lot of victims and a lot of victims' children, and probably helped abusers, too, because as long as they're in the situation, they'll never get help.
Well, yes, and I work close with our Batterers Intervention Program, and he actually requires all of his attendees to attend our domestic violence vigil, which we held in October once a year. And so they actually get to see it from an outsider's point of view, where they get to stand up. They actually get up and hear survivors talk about what they went through, about what their kids went through, about the fear. And luckily this year I was able to actually bring a male victim who was a victim of domestic violence as a child. And he's now a chief of police, and they were actually able to hear it from what their children are going through. And it makes a huge impact, and especially in the South, you have, people call it the good old boy system, to where, you know, if you know the right person, then, you know, they're going to turn a blind eye to it. But what I've really tried to focus on is the fact that they are criminals. They are breaking the law. And I don't care who they are. They deserve to be treated just like everybody else that breaks the law does.
I agree.
Me too.
I agree very, very much.
Go, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
Amanda, is that information on your website?
Yeah, actually, a little bit of it is, but if not, there's a link to email me if you are interested. And I do, I share the curriculum that I've developed with anybody across the state, across the United States, that wants to actually train their law enforcement or that wants to get their law enforcement, prosecution, and judges more involved. And it is because it's taking me close to 4 years to get our whole countywide involved in this program. But we also started for law enforcement to where we actually created business cards that are leave safe cards with the leave safe list on the back of it of what a victim needs to take from her house as she leaves. But on the front of it, it shows what services we provide. And we provide those all now to all of our law enforcement in our county. And so they're able to give a business card size so the woman can conceal it if she needs to whenever they go out onto a call that is a domestic violence call. And so that way there's not one victim that's left not knowing that there is help out there.
And what is that link?
It's actually on our website, and
there's
a place to email me. It's called angels@selenesafehaven.org.
You know, we've done a lot of different programs over the 9 years we've been on the air, and I can't think of one that has more important email or link information that'll be on our website. So those of you listening to the program today, I know we've said a lot of things, but I'll have all that information on our website, too. I do want to thank all three of my guests for being with me today talking about domestic violence. I can only say in wrapping up that this is what I thought it would be, a very tough program to talk about. I wish we could talk for a lot more. And so that's another good reason, those of you listening, if this is important to you, you want to share it with someone in your family, the podcast, which is the longer version, will be at our website at yttshow.org. I do want to thank all three of my guests. Charlotte Carroll has been my guest from the older generation. She joined us from Stuttgart, where she's the founder of Restoration of Hope. Again, I'll have that information for her location there on our website. Charlotte, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Phil. And I would like to add, too, that the police officers and sheriff's department play a traumatic part in protecting these victims. We can only do so much, but they can do so much more than we can. And we need them desperately to fight this battle with us and to get all of the training that they possibly can so that they can understand the plight of domestic violence.
That's very important. Amanda White has been our guest from the younger generation. She joined us from Saline County, where she's one of the volunteer outreach coordinators there for SalineCountySafeHaven.org. Again, that'll be on our website. Amanda, I'm really glad you could give us that information today.
Thank you. And like I said, I mean, for anybody out there listening, if they ever need help or any information, I actually trained this past year, and I'm actually a reserve sheriff's officer now. So I actually am law enforcement teaching law enforcement.
Good.
So that might make some of a difference, because sometimes that's the only time law enforcement listens.
Yeah.
It's whenever it's coming from law enforcement. But
yeah.
Doing this radio show is a wonderful thing. And as Leslie and both have said, I mean, it's just a matter of speaking out and the letting someone know, anyone
right.
know, even if it can just be your pastor or, I mean, heck, even your mailman, if that's the only person that you ever see. So.
Well, thanks so much, Amanda.
Thank you for having me.
And then our special guest joining us from Washington, D.C. has been author Leslie Morgan Steiner. She has the book out right now, Crazy Love. She also wrote Mommy Wars. She's one of the New York Times bestselling authors. Leslie Morgan Steiner, so happy that you were able to join us here again today. I know are you about ready to wrap up your tour, or how are you doing on that?
No, I still am. You know, it's a timeless subject, so I plan on continuing to travel around the country and talking to people as much as they want to listen to me. And I want to thank everybody on the show for sharing your stories. And Phil, I want to thank you for having the show and for sharing your own personal story, too, because it's really powerful. Thank you to Charlotte Carroll and Amanda White for all your good work. I tell you, if I ever need help, I'm calling the two of you.
Well, folks, thanks so much for listening to the program this evening. Our program next week is a lot lighter. We did a program last week on masculinity. We're going to do next week, our program will be on femininity. So I think that'll be another interesting topic. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you then. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.